Welcome to meeting number 2 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 25th, 2013.
Hi, this is John. Happy to be here. Happy to see you here. Today, as promised, I'm going to talk a little bit about the fear of life before starting our conversations with one another. You know, in my case, the looking came years before the insight that the fear of life was the true cause of my dissatisfaction with myself and my life. And I doubt seriously that I would have ever suspected or even noticed the presence of the context of fear had I not already rid myself of it beforehand. God knows that many have gone before me into the presumption that our misery and our liberation were in some way supernatural. And I suspect that I'm not sure what saved me from that. But in any event, I was saved from that. But in the end, it took me 13 years, more than 13 years, to see this powerful insight into the actual underlying cause of our misery and the possibility of being free of it. Strictly speaking, there's no requirement at all that you understand the cause of the misery before you can get rid of it. The looking will eradicate the fear with no preconditions of any kind. So the fear will go whether you know of it or not, but I believe, based on my own experience and based on the experience now of many more people that I am graciously permitted to hear from, that knowing the actual cause of the problem that the looking cures will profoundly affect the course of recovery from the consequences of a life crippled by that fear. Again, it's the course of recovery that's affected, and the closing of useless speculations about what has actually happened, you know, like I was uplifted into heaven, or I was enlightened, or I was whatever it was. It prevents the meandering and that kind of speculation about what the looking has actually done and why it's done it. Makes things a lot easier. So about fear. The fear of life itself comes upon almost all of us accidentally at birth. Nobody's at fault. When the shock and violence of our arrival sets the context within which our entire psychology, all of our understandings, all of our bedrock assumptions, all of our likes and dislikes and our sense of identity will take form. The fear of life is a psychological immune disease. It seeks to protect us from the danger of being alive by holding life itself at arm's length. It warps the lens of personal psychology through which we perceive, it's the only means through which we perceive, the meaning, validity, and likely effect of everything whatsoever that happens to us, or with us, or within us, or around us. It actually creates and maintains the delusion that life is not safe, that life is not to be trusted. This illusion, this presence of the noxious atmosphere of the fear of life, is the cause of all human aggression and self-destructive behavior. That is really, really obvious. It poisons our relationship with one another and with the earth itself. All of our self-hatred, all of our hatred of others, all of our self-defeating and aggressive habits of behavior and relationship, all of our misery, all of our confusion, all of our disappointment in ourselves and in our lives spring from that one simple cause, the fear of life, the context that drives us insane. And by the way, there actually is a surprising level of agreement among mental health professionals for this view that the fear triggered by birth is the cause of much misery throughout life. And you can read more about that if you download the Radical Act paper from the site. But the fear of life is not among the natural fears that we're familiar with, that come and go in relation to arising events in our lives. Not the natural anxiety of getting caught in traffic, going to be late for work. That's natural. The fear that comes from seeing an ugly mole on you and wanting to find out what it is, that's natural. The terror that might strike if it suddenly looks like some car is going to run you down, that's natural. The fear of life is not that kind of fear. It's not that kind of immediate experience of fearfulness that comes in response to actual danger that arises within our lives. The fear of life actually shuns interest or awareness of itself of any kind. It remains a silent and false assumption that life is untrustworthy and dangerous. It is not the overt fear, it's not even the overt fears that it triggers in the psychology. It is beneath that. It is the context that creates incoherent fears and anxieties and so forth. So it's not something that we feel. It's not something that we need to get rid of the feeling of. You know, we know a lot about how we can deal with over fearfulness and so forth as it comes up in our life, it comes up in our mind, over fearfulness and anxiety and dread and all of that. We know that there's things we can do to minimize the effect of those things in the moment. But, of course, they always come back. It's like whack-a-mole trying to deal with those instances of fear that are themselves have no basis for existence. But the fear of life is not that. The fear of life is not that feeling of being afraid. It's not that feeling of being suspicious of things. It's not that at all. It is the context that creates the mechanism that excretes those fears and those apprehensions, anxieties. Because the presence of that assumption, although it has no direct influence on us, it doesn't affect us directly. It's not something we can see and do something about. But it stains the development of the entire psychological structure. It creates a constant atmosphere of resistance to any effort to change this fundamental psychology from outside of its influence. This is why the difficulties with psychotherapy are what they are. Because when things are, well, you see what I'm talking about. Once you get this insight, once you actually get the insight as to the nature of the fear of life and the ubiquity of its effects in the psychology itself, once you really see that, I tell you, you actually will see that the fear of life explains everything previously hidden about the perversity of human behavior. It actually explains everything. It makes everything so clear. The things that used to be so filled with weight and heaviness and portent are seen in their true light as will-o'-the-wisps, as the smoke of thought. The point of all this is that knowing the actual cause of the problem reveals first that you are not responsible for the madness of your own mind. You are not responsible for the madness of your own mind. You are not responsible for the perverse activity in the psychology at all. And not only are you not responsible for the madness of your mind, and this comes just as in the, it's not something that appears, oh my God, I'm not responsible. It just is the case. It has always been the case, and all of the stupidity that has been present around it disappears. And it's just obvious that you're not responsible for the craziness of your mind, for the wanting of things that are not good for you, for the resistance to things that are good for you, anything, all of that. And when you see that, really, you see that you really don't have to attend to its shenanigans as it disintegrates the mind, the sick mind. You really don't have to pay attention to it. You don't need to constantly worry over stupid thoughts. You don't need to constantly worry over worrying about everything. You may continue to do so for a time, but seeing the actual cause of what persists even after the looking destroys the context of fear makes the relationship with what still persists after the looking much cleaner and clearer and absolutely absent of any aggressive or negative relationship with the thoughts and the madness in your mind. It's just the madness in your mind. It's just thoughts. It's just the shenanigans of the personality shaped by fear on its way out the door. The almost worshipful relationship with thought and belief vanishes completely. Thoughts and concerns that would previously have been a cause for obsessive concern are now known to be of no consequence. So although it's not necessary that you understand the fear of life and its nature to free yourself of influence and to rid yourself of its psychological minions, I promise you, you will find the understanding empowering and helpful as life begins to rush in on you when the fear goes away. So I would like for us today to focus our conversations and focus our attention on this business of the cause of the problem, on this business of the fear of life, so that in doing so, like if I can be in conversation with you folks about this, in honest conversation in which the things that seem off to you are revealed to me. You show me what the things are that seem wrong to you. The things that seem right to you, you show me the things that seem right to you. And in so doing, we all benefit from it because I get a little bit better at bringing this to people. And I think, I really want to stress this. I really think that, although it's true, that the looking does not require it. Although it's true that anyone who does the looking, and this seems to be just the case, will embark upon the same kind of unfolding of the psychology and the life that has been the case with most of us, I suppose, or at least is in process of most of us. Understanding what it is that caused the problem in the first place, seeing it for the really insignificant, inconsequential mistake that it is, well, it can be really, really useful, not only in making the recovery from the disease easier and smoother and less difficult, more, you know, to relate to it with more open attention and understanding. But I suspect that it will dramatically decrease the confusion that often ensues in the aftermath of the looking and the psychological pain that that is created by that confusion. So help me get better at understanding it. Help me get better at speaking about it. And we'll all benefit from it. There's one last thing. One thing off topic with that. I don't know whether. Let me see. I guess I want to make one clarification from my talk yesterday with Barbara. I strongly advised Barbara and all of you to go to the forums to start actually seeing what's happening to people in their own words and in their own confusion, in their own clarity, there in the forums, and I continue to do so, I encourage that. I think that it's enormously helpful to those who are in the throes of the recovery from the fear. The ability to speak with one another about it, and that is confirmed by those who are speaking about it. But I want to make one thing, I want to make one suggestion to you, to all of you, anybody who has not been to the forums or who went to the forums and found them too big to make a dent in. And that's this. When you start reading in the forums, in fact, this is good for anything whatsoever that you start considering. But specifically, when you start reading in the forums, just decline to follow any idea that you are required to have an opinion about what you're reading immediately. You hear that? You don't have to have an opinion about what you're reading immediately or ever, really. The point of the conversation is to hear what the other person is trying to convey through the difficulty of saying anything clearly, coupled with the difficulty of understanding what's being said through all the confusion injected into the conversation by the idiosyncratic nature of everything that we talk about to one another. Again, the point is, don't think that you have to have an opinion. Let your understanding and the usefulness of the work in the forums appear naturally as it does to you. Don't look for the point of things. Don't try to have an opinion. Just let it, just read it. Just watch it. Just look at it. And probably not all that great an idea to start posting yourself until you have a sense that you actually have an idea of what's happening there. I just wanted to clear that up in case I was confusing about that yesterday. So that's it. That's the best I can do for now. Please talk to me about it. I will be here waiting to hear from you. Thank you for paying attention. Roger?
I just want to say that it's good news to hear that the feeling of responsibility can weigh very heavy I'll speak for myself, maybe on other people too, that you know, this fear that we seem to be born into, or born with, or somehow gets attached to by some, gets attached in various ways, you know, there's a kind of like innocence about it, that the fear just sort of appears, and we get attached to it, and then it carries on, and all the trouble begins. So that's really good news, actually, to underline that. And also, you said it took you 13 years, so to get to 13 years of get an understanding, you know, and I feel, well, oh, thank God. The last, I thought 3 years took long. I've been trying. I thought 3 years was a long time, and now that I heard 13 years, it gives me a lot of hope that, you know, I still got another 10 more years, maybe more.
Well, hopefully it won't be that. You know, the reason it took me 13 years, I'm convinced the reason it took me 13 years really for this all to come together is because nobody told me what the actual cause was. If I had known what the actual cause of things was back 13 years before it, I think things would have gone much, much quicker and less complicated for me. But that probably wouldn't have given me some of the things that the confusion gave me in the years that I spent trying to understand by having conversations with people. That those years in which people like yourself and others over time have been generous enough with their time and attention to be patient with me when I myself was very clear about the fact that I didn't know what I was talking about. I wouldn't give those up for anything. But nobody else has to go through that. You know, that's the point. And I like the what you said about the innocence of it. You know, even there is no fault to be found anywhere. The appearance of the fear at birth is nobody's fault. Even the fear, the context of fear itself, is innocent in that it arose as a more or less natural reaction to a really, really difficult situation, which is taking birth as a human. So I like the innocence. And the fear is innocent, too. You know, there's no devil there stirring the pot. It's just a normal event within the realm of cause and effect in existence itself. So I like the innocence. I'm going to use that. Okay?
Yeah, I guess the fear is it's innocent.
Fear is what?
It's innocent.
Yes, it is. It's innocent. It's not.
In my own case, you know, the last couple of years, I've been trying sort of desperately to get my permanent visa back in Denmark after living here for many years. And then we had to move away from Denmark, and then we came back. The politics here got a lot more conservative, so it was a real struggle. Something that just came very easy a long time ago, and became a huge struggle because immigration became a big issue. And I could remember just not being able to go to sleep, just thinking about the massive amount of bureaucracy connected to it in my financial situation, and night after night after night, and it just seemed like eternal that these people just had my wife or myself kind of like hostage. But you know, when I looked a little bit deeper, when I came some years back to your to some of the meetings, I felt like, oh my God, is this just a symptom of the fear? And,
yes.
And you know, I began looking at this, like every night staring at the in the face at 3 o'clock in the morning, because it seemed like, you know, that's about the time when my mind would click in. You know, I couldn't go to sleep or something. And it took all sorts of things to try to get kind of calm enough to go back to sleep, because thoughts would just go out of control. And, you know, one, it really helped, you know, your pioneering, and your, many of the times you kept on hitting the same nail about the fear. And then Justin, about a year ago, the whole thing just kind of dropped out of my consciousness. I felt like, oh, well, I don't care anymore. What happens? it's inconsequential, you know, what, but before it seemed so important that I would get this visa. And I mean, now I have it, you know, and I'm talking about an 8-year process. So, but it really didn't connect with me until I started, you know, coming to your meetings. And then I felt like, oh, this is just a symptom of the fear of life. So.
Yeah. I'll tell you something else too, and this is important to say, and you may be saying this, I don't know. But if, for the sake of everyone else, something else that's really important to see, and that is that all of the madness that now afflicts the entire world of human activity in whatever country. What country are you in?
Denmark, Scandinavia. Denmark.
And I'm, of course, in the United States, and I'm 70 years old, so I have seen quite a profound change in the political and economic and social climate of this country in that time. And of course, I see what's happening in Europe, and I see what's happening in the Middle East and in Russia and in China and in North Korea and all those places. And the thing is that all of that also is symptomatic of the fear. The way in which the fearful wanting to shut everything down and not provide anything for people, the preference of giving preference to the rich over the not rich, the movement toward war, the movement, the whole scope of the current insanity of the human creature is due to the fear. It's not due to anybody who, any of those who are actually in the unenviable position of being the ones who the fear has caused to turn against their fellow human beings and their fellow countrymen and so forth. It's the fear that's causing it all. And so that although there is something to be gained by political activity and things of that nature, you know, because what are you going to do? What's going to bring it to an end in the end? Is for the fear to be gone from the human creature entirely. And when that happens, everything will change. Nothing will be the same. And until then, the momentum and the weight of the fear on the human creature for the last 50,000 years or so controls everything. It's the cause of it all. It's the cause of all the murder, all the corruption, all the everything. So that's another thing to see. Nobody out there is at fault for what they're doing, really. The fear is the problem. The looking is the solution. And also, even the efforts to improve stuff in the world situation, are contaminated by the fearfulness, which causes the need to perceive who is the enemy and what can be done to stop the enemy from doing what they're doing. When, you know, I don't know, in the Avaaz petition I put in a line from Pogo, which was a cartoon character many, many years ago, who made the statement, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." And that's what we're about here. Okay? Follow that?
Yeah, I think the term is frenemy.
Is what?
Frenemy.
Frenemy, yeah. Okay.
That's what I see floating around.
Yes, but that too, right, is an attempt to water down the natural impulse to find the enemy. And often that idiom, the frenemy, is used in with a kind of a silent wink at the idea that we have to keep our friends closer and our enemy, our friends close and our enemies closer. It's all the assumption that somebody is wrong. Somebody is responsible for this. And the truth is, that's simply not the case. It's the fear that's the problem. It's the fear that drives people crazy. All of those despicable personalities performing despicable acts and despicable assaults on human dignity and human and natural human compassion are driven themselves by fear, nothing more. All the psychological mechanisms that makes it possible for them to do the things they do are psychological mechanisms that have appeared in the particular circumstance of their life to serve the assumption that the life is fearful and untrustworthy. And that also is quite a liberating insight to see that everything we've done, everything we've thought to be the problem, everybody we've thought to be the problem, we were wrong about. And as long as we continue, it's not that we cannot do work in the physical world, and it's not that we cannot do work that's political in nature and even contentious in nature. But whatever we do, when it's illuminated by the understanding that the people who are actually implementing the agenda of the fear are themselves victims of the fear, it makes it much makes our circumstance much clearer and the way forward much easier. Do you follow that?
Yeah, I think I've had my own, I don't have to look to world politics. I can just...
Yeah, right.
I can look inside the insanity of my own life sometimes. And also, it's interesting to be, to share with, when I listen to other people get off. The other thing that I had sort of quandered pondered about a little bit is that... in the sense of the looking, I just take it as a trust or a faith. It's like medicine. The doctor gives you some medicine, and then you don't know what's in it. You just take it because you're sick. And then you just cross your fingers and hope to God it'll work.
Yeah.
And then you take it accordingly to the instructions but it can be retroactive, it's like it all the while. I think that when I became aware, I don't know if there's a point in time I can say it was an awareness of the looking, I was attracted to this message, years ago, but I didn't really hear it in this context. But so this feeling of me really, really kind of, I find you get to an indefinable point with it where you can know it, but you can't really speak about it anymore. You just, when you get into this zone, you're there, but then you know, there's no sense to talk about it, because the minute you try to say something, it takes you out of, takes you away from who you are in a way, because all your attention goes to what you're saying rather than.
Yes, that's true. And what's true is that the feeling of you is way too small, way too lacking in quality of any intensity. That feeling is faint, it's clear, and unperturbed, unmoving. And when you look at yourself, when you look at that, which is you, when you look at that, words fail, because there's not much there that anything can be said about. So that when we try to say things about it, about our actual nature as experienced in the act of looking, when we try to say something about it, it is, as you suggest, it's not like there's no particular value in staying in the awareness of your actual nature. There's no particular value to that. Everything about life is the engagement with circumstance and experience that are constantly arising within consciousness itself. But what is actually true is that if you try to say something about it, you immediately are misrepresenting it. What I just said about it, it's clear, it's plain, it's whatever I just said about it, is immediately seen to be not it. It actually is not the case. Everything that's said about it is an abstraction. And then we get into the abstractions of the difference between my false self and my true self, or awareness, or whatever. And that's mostly where the mind that itself has already had the persistent mental structures that are already in place when the actual, I don't know what to call it, the actual moment arises when the context disappears, it's still those psychological structures that are the only things available to, with which to consider for yourself what's happened. So that anything, whatever, that's said about it is, first of all, way too much that can be said about it. And second of all, anything that's said about it at that time is contaminated by the mechanism that we use to think about things and to assign value and qualities to. So the thing is, right, that the act of looking, and we're going to get into this tomorrow, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about the act of looking too, that is just natural. It's not anything that is unexpected. But there's a lot of misunderstanding about that too, about what it does and why it does it and what you do with it and so forth and so on, just as there is about the cause of the problem in itself. But the looking, I'm going to just say this as a off topic, the looking is not as big a deal as it's made of. It doesn't require constant refreshing. It is true that once the looking occurs, there's a natural impulse to do it again and again, but that need not be seen, that need not be put in a context that is created by the psychology that thinks that it has to be this or that. Anyway, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay?
Okay. Thanks, John. Thanks a lot.
I hope we were helpful in this conversation. You helped me. I hope I helped you.
Well, I just wanted to share that it seemed, I'm just happy to hear it. You know, I thought 3 years was a long time, so I have more prospecting to do, and I'm getting more patient. Some of the symptoms have mysteriously disappeared. So there's been some small things that have showed me that there's a lot of value. So what to do.
Yeah, right. And you'll notice that, you know, and I still, from time to time, I will notice, and these things don't get acted on anymore, but they are like remnants, like the Japanese soldiers hiding in the jungle after the war was over. Now, I still see thought ideas and conclusions about things that appear within my mind. I still see that, and I see them, and then they kind of go away and never come back again. But there's still those persistent, you know, they have ways of looking at things that have not yet seen the light of day in the aftermath of the destruction of the context, still come up sometimes, and I see them and they go away. So there. And so that's a process that goes on for a long time. It doesn't take a very long time before you notice that there's nothing to worry about them. There's no reason for you to try to make them go away or anything. But they stay for a while. Okay?
Okay. Thanks a lot, John.
Oh, thank you, Roger. It's good to see you. Are you well, physically?
I don't try to think about my health too much. No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I've had a good turnaround, but that's enough.
Okay. Okay.
Things are good.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Barbara?
I was just thinking, I understand how the looking affects the fear of life. I'm wondering what you think about how the looking affects the fear of death.
The fear of death?
Yes.
The neurotic, obsessive fear of death as something that is mysterious and ugly and horrifying and so forth, that goes pretty quickly. Obviously, there's no, like, the actual useful fears that have to do with maintaining life, the natural fears that would come if you find that you have something seriously wrong with your body, the natural fear that comes to try to fix that and try to live longer, there's nothing wrong with that. That's quite healthy. And it is not neurotic and is not obsessive. But where most of us are burdened with a unnatural anticipation and anxiety and terror about dying. And that when fear of death arises in circumstances in which there is no threat to life, that doesn't happen anymore. That kind of chewing on it and worrying about it or trying to get rid of it or whatever, that doesn't happen anymore. Just live life naturally. Nobody wants to die. The purpose of being alive is being alive. But that neurotic obsessive focus on death as a problem disappears. Do you follow that?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. It's not that you don't want to stay alive. It's just that oh my God, you know, I've read recently, I'm going to just say this as an aside because it's kind of relevant. I recently read at the recommendation of somebody that I don't think is here. I read the autobiographical sketch of Tolstoy. It's called Confessions. And I'm certain that Tolstoy is not not alive in everybody's in everybody's consciousness and so forth. But Tolstoy set out in his he was an intellectual. He wrote War and Peace, Anna Karenina. He wrote a bunch of stuff, all great Russian novels. And he was also very spiritual, and he was obsessed with the fear of death. And he wasn't obsessed with the fear of death so much as he was obsessed with life, and felt that death invalidated everything that he had ever done. Every word that he had spoken, every thought that he had thought, every good work that he had done to people, with people, that death wiped out the meaning of them and made everything while alive meaningless because of death. And he goes on and on for quite a while about his fixation on the power of death to invalidate the meaning of life. And that goes away. And the point I'm trying to make is that the neurotic, obsessive obsession with death and its meaning is part of the fear of life and nothing else. And when the fear of life goes, that goes. Okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Julia.
I want to ask you something, because yesterday you mentioned that actually you are going in all different directions and all the other teachings are going, and I have been witness and I participated in a lot of workshop where they are talking about that it's not a you in here. So yesterday you said the contrary, actually it's a you in here, it's an individuality. And all the other teachings are teaching, actually, there is not a you, there is nobody here.
Right, that's really bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to believe that. I mean, I don't know if believe might be too strong a word, but I assumed that that was the actual case and that it was understanding and the insight into the non-existence of me that would liberate me from the misery of being human. It's just not so. The one thing that cannot be denied is the presence of you. Everything else can be and has been by novelists and all kinds of people over the years. Everything else has been shown to be inexistent in a certain sense, certain metaphysical sense. The only thing that doesn't go away is you. And the insistence that the person must disappear is a misunderstanding of the fact that once the fear is gone, what used to be thought of as the person, follow me, what used to be thought of as the person, which has been always the personality, the psychology, the mind itself, once the fear goes, that person disappears. That sense of me being this bundle of thoughts and likes and dislikes and relationships and history and future and so forth and so on, that's all part of the psychology. And that is entirely malleable. It's not true. It changes as time goes on. And when the fear goes, that psychology, not instantly, but over time, goes too. And from a standpoint in which the actual cause and cure is assumed to be something supernatural, metaphysical, in a mind that has been formed in that context, the only place to go to explain what has happened is that the most obvious thing, which is that bundle of psychological relationships and ideas and so forth and so on has disappeared. And in fact, the conscious awareness of the presence of the psychology kind of disappears too, because the psychology, instead of being formed to keep us away from life, is replaced by a psychology that is sane and natural, which is to give us the tools and the understandings and everything that help us be effective in life. And so there's no longer this separation, this sense, this false separation between the unfolding of my life and the personality, the so-called ego, that is watching it and being affected by it and affecting it to whatever extent it is. That distinction just kind of disappears. So in a mind that has been conditioned, the basic conditioning is that the problem is that existence of that personality with all of its stupidity, all of its ridiculousness, all of its insanity. When that's seen to be the problem, when the personality is seen to be the problem, when the personality disappears, it's natural that since the personality is also seen to be me, when that disappears, it's natural to go to the assumption that I have disappeared. That actually, what I actually thought should happen has happened, and I have wiped out me. And that's all a compelling and coherent tale that's told. It's something that is, you know, persuasive and attractive and so forth and so on. So we go for it too, because we are not even free of the idea that the personality is there. We're not even free of the idea that I am not the personality. So it's not surprising that those ideas come to those who have honestly rid themselves of the fear without, in a context in which they really did not know what happened, and try to be helpful to us and try to explain what happened by saying that, well, the I is inexistent. You do not exist. You are nothing. And what has to happen is the wiping away of the ignorance that causes you to believe that you actually exist. But actual experience puts the lie to that. The actual experience of looking to see what it feels like not to be true self or awareness or consciousness or anything of the kind, but by looking to see what it feels like to be me, that completely invalidates the entire scheme. That what the problem is that I am ignorantly assuming that I am something when actually I am nothing, and that when the feeling that I am something goes away, I'll be free. So, again, nobody's at fault, but it's just self-evidently false. I mean, you know, there are metaphysical arguments that could be made for the inexistence of anything whatsoever. And there are interesting philosophical discursions and so forth, but they're just play. It's the truth of the matter is that the one thing that certainly exists is me. That's for sure. That's never in doubt. And the only difference then, or the main difference is, that I see me to be just exactly me, and not some supernatural being or some supernatural curse that has come upon me, but me, who has been ill-served by a mechanism of psychology that was itself contaminated and poisoned by the arrival of the terror that strikes at birth. Then everything is much easier. and because it's and it's easier because it is actually consistent with the fact of the matter, without regard to metaphysical ruminations. Do you follow me?
Yes, I do. I do, actually. And another thing is, you know, I listen to Papaji and other teachers, and they say, well, the best thing, if you're too confused and if you have too many problems, you know, and you don't succeed with meditation, the best thing is I go to sleep. Just go and sleep. And you say,
now that is really a telling piece of advice, because my feeling is that all of the recommendations, let me rephrase that. All of the recommendations that come within the realm of spiritual aspiration that I am familiar with, actually, although they may think that they are in favor of waking up, they actually advise going back to sleep, withdrawing from life, withdrawing from thought, withdrawing from experience.
So, John, I'm doing this looking already, my goodness, we know each other from 2007, and I know that some people have more success than others in looking, like some people are like at your level maybe, or some close to you, I don't know if we can categorize it on levels or what. But I can say that I am more aware about that psychological game when it pops in, and I look at it, and I let it just to go away. But very often, I'm having the thought, I really want to die. I really would love to get off this planet for once and for all. What do you have to say about that? Because this would go.
What do you mean by holding on to that thought? What does that entail? How do you do that?
Because it comes often. It comes often. Like
that has nothing to do with you, Julia. That thought means nothing. You don't hold on to it. It's a thought. It comes. You have a relationship with it that is contaminated by the structure of fearfulness, because you think there's something to that thought that it shouldn't be there. But it's just a thought. It does no harm whatsoever. None. Zero. And the goal that is rational and intelligent and sane regarding troublesome thoughts is not to make them go away. You know, like if they went away, everything would be all right. That's an old game in the arena of the fear. That's not the point. The point is that thought that arises, when it arises, it is a thought about some present, it's kind of a perception of some present existing sensation. That sensation might be big, it might be little, it might be anything, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with death. It is a thought about a sensation that has worked to protect you from life for a long time. But it's just a thought. It can't do anything. So that the idea that the thought is the problem, is a misdirection that's caused by the persistence of the symptoms of the fear. That's the problem. That thought's the problem. If that would go away, everything would be okay. That's that's the work of the fear. Now, the truth is the thought doesn't do anything. Then there probably is present, when that thought is present, some probably faint sensation present in you. So what I advise about all of that is to, first of all, see that the whole thing really doesn't matter whether it stays or goes. You know, it's like one of those things which like the things that come to me from time to time, although they're not of that nature. But there are things I notice from time to time that have just been hiding out in the jungle. It doesn't matter that they've been hiding out in the jungle. It doesn't matter whether that thought comes or goes. That's not the problem. That has never been the problem. So that rather than focus on the significance of that thought constantly recurring, which is another thought, by the way, instead of focusing on the significance of that, just notice that the thought is present. And then, using your ability to move your attention, to decline to attend to what doesn't need attending to, and to attend to what you want to attend to, using that power you have to move your attention, just, again, look at the thought, notice it's there, and then see if there's not a sensation present within you that thought actually is referring to when it's, or that is causing that thought to arise. It doesn't matter whether you find it or not. This is all just, this has nothing to do with bringing about a diminishment of that thought or the thing that gives rise to that thought. It's all about strengthening your ability to choose what you attend to and what you do not attend to so that you become skillful and intelligent in doing the only thing you can do within your life, which is to decide what is worth attending to and what is not worth attending to. So first you look at the thought. Ah, there's that thought again. Huh. What's it about? What's that thought about? Is there a feeling here, a sensation here? That the thought is talking about? Can I see it? Do I know what it is? Well, maybe it's that, maybe it's not that, okay. And then after you've done that, move your attention to your breath, to the feeling of your breath coming in and out of your body, to breathing. Just move your attention there. And don't worry about whether the thought goes or comes or stays, because the thought doesn't hurt you. Nothing about a thought can hurt you. And nothing about a sensation that gives rise to a thought can hurt you. Nothing. So you move to breathing, because breathing is real, it is physical, and it is reliable, and it generally doesn't give rise to paranoid delusions about things. Do you hear me?
Yes, I do. Thank you so much. Yes, yes. It's very useful what you told me, yes.
I'm glad
to hear. It was just that that thought is recurring often, and I was saying, well, you know, I disregard it, but most of the time, but there are times when it really hurts me, and it really kind of, you know, takes me to a deeper depression, and it's like that persistence, it was kind of... And repetitiveness.
It's not the thought that does that. It's not the thought that does that. It's the entire array of relationship to the thought that does that.
Yes.
And the point of what I'm saying is that you can use the thought to strengthen your ability to be useful to yourself in your own life by strengthening the skill and intelligence with which you move your attention. Do you follow me?
Yes, yes.
Then that thought becomes your ally and not the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes, thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Okay. Good to hear from you, Joanna.
Good to hear you, too. Good to be with you guys here. Thank you. Thanks a million.
Okay. Anybody else? We got a little bit more time if anybody else wants to talk. Okay, well, if there's nothing left for us to talk about, then we should just wrap this up. Thank you very much for the time you spent with me today. The conversations were very useful to me, and I hope they were useful to all of you too, and to anybody who eventually hears this in the future. We're on to something really good here, really fantastic, unlike anything that has happened before. And we need to take it seriously, and we need and this is where responsibility comes in. Nobody's responsible for what's happening, but we need to take responsibility for what we do from here on out. We cannot afford to wait for deliverance from a supernatural source. We cannot afford to continue to be driven and manipulated by a context and an understanding and an assumption that is absolutely false. We need to learn and become good at understanding what we can do and what we cannot do. And we need to become good at bringing the news of this simple and unbelievably effective act to the world of human beings before there is no longer a world of human beings, which seems to be what we are heading for, really, this time, not as a media event, as a slow disintegration of human society. So stay with me. I love you all. We're pretty excited. We're doing a lot of new stuff. We're reaching a lot of people, and I'm very happy to be here. Carla has some things that she needs to say to you, and I'll see you tomorrow. Carla?
You just listened to meeting number 2 of a 5-day online intensive with John Sherman, broadcast live from Ojai, California on June 25th, 2013. For more live recordings, visit our podcast at www.justonenote.org.